So this morning we're going to begin the and finish the second and third letters of John. I'll begin by looking at the introduction and take you through that first to get us a bit of setting for the letter, the contents of the letter. It's a typical letter, by the way, of that it fits on one parchment sheet, which was quite normal. I've already told you that 1 John is not actually a letter at all. It's a thesis or a homily or a reflection. There's no introduction, there's no goodbye at the end. So we're now, it's a thesis. Now the letter is very closely attached to it, this second letter. Some even suggest this might be the covering letter that was sent. You couldn't prove that, but they're very intimately connected at any rate. So all are agreed that the Gospel of John and the three letters of John are written from within the one community, well described by Raymond Brown as the community of the beloved disciple. However, the information given us in the various writings and the witness of tradition are insufficient to provide certainty as to exactly how the Gospel and the three letters are related. This letter and the so-called third letter of John are written by someone who introduces himself simply as the elder. The Greek is presbyteros, so you could translate it the presbyter or the elder. In the history of the church, Eusebius quotes from the exposition of the oracles of the Lord written by Papias of Hierapolis about 130 AD. In which Papias speaks of two different men called John, both buried in Ephesus, one the apostle, whom in fact Eusebius assumes to be the writer of the gospel, and that is the tradition, and the other is a presbyter called John. I've got the text here for you. If then, writes Papias, as I said very early in the second century, if then anyone came who had been a follower of the elders, of the presbyters, I questioned him in regard to the words of the elders, what Andrew or what Peter said, or what was said by Philip, or by Thomas, or by James, or by John, or by Matthew, or by any other of the disciples of the Lord. As you can see, he's talking about the 12 apostles there. And he was very interested in finding out, people who knew them, what did they say? Words. And, he adds, what things Aristian and the presbyter John, or it could be the elder John, the disciples of the Lord say? Different group, a later group, but leadership group. For I didn't think that what was to be gotten from the books would profit me as much as what came from the living and abiding voice. And he adds, Eusebius, the statement of those is true who say that there were two persons in Asia that bore the same name, and that there were two tombs in Ephesus, each of which, even to the present day, is called John's. So he'd visited the cemetery, and there were two statements at the cemetery of John, another one John, John the Apostle, John the Presbyter. So therefore we continue. Early tradition is unanimous in giving John as the name of the beloved disciple, the author of the gospel. And I'll give you that here. Irenaeus, writing towards the end of the second century, identifies the author of the gospel as, now we're quoting from his book Against the Heresies, John, the disciple of the Lord who'd leant back on his breast. Referring, of course, to the Last Supper. And that's quoted also by Eusebius. Likewise, Origen, in his commentary on the Gospel, written little bit before the middle of the 3rd century, writes, "It's likely that the one reclining on Jesus' breast, one of the disciples whom Jesus loved, was John, who wrote the Gospel." So Origen's done his homework too, but he's not absolutely certain. He says it's likely, a careful scholar that he is. Augustine, in his first tractate on John, preached about 410 AD, says, "John reclined on the breast of the Lord and drank that which he might give to us to drink." And from then on, Augustine having spoken, that became the absolute tradition that the beloved disciple, whom we know about, named in the Gospel, the 4th Gospel, is identified with John the Apostle. And so it has been, and that's what you grew up with, I'm sure. That's been the long tradition of the Church. Though most assume that the Gospel was written by John the Apostle, Polycrates, a bishop of Ephesus, which would make you think that he might know, writing at the end of the 2nd century, about 190 AD, he identifies the beloved disciple as John the Presbyter, this John. It's clear that, and you can imagine that confusion rising with the two Johns, a very common name in the time. It's clear that the Gospel received its final form after the death of the beloved disciple. And the letters would appear to be dealing with a situation which belongs to a period that also comes after the writing of the bulk of the Gospel, if not after its final editing. Like 1 John, this letter is written by someone of recognized authority. It's concerned with the same problems as 1 John, and it offers the same solutions using the same terms. It's reasonable to work on the hypothesis that both documents were composed by the one person, one of the early disciples of the beloved disciple himself. He may also be the one who was responsible for the final editing of the Gospel. And I think I mentioned that to you once before. Chapter 21, for example, is clearly written after the death of the beloved disciple, and it's suggested that some of the Last Supper discourse, because there are actually 3 discourses in John's Gospel, one of them ends, and so they let us go. And if you read from the end of chapter 14 to chapter 18, verse 1, it's absolutely continuous. You'd expect it. Something is at hand, I've forgotten the exact words, let us go. And then he goes to the garden. But in the middle then, there's chapter 15, 16, and 17, which seem to be 2 separate documents, 2 separate homilies, perhaps, preached by the beloved disciple, but introduced because the people who are editing the last part of the Gospel, it was too beautiful to leave out, as you well know. I am the vine, you're the branches, and the prayer of Jesus, the Last Supper, introduced the beloved disciples' perhaps homilies into the written text. So you're dealing with a living thing, a constant writing. Someone brought up an example to me last week, which is not bad. J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, and he wrote all these books. Well, when he died, his son gathered a whole lot of his manuscripts, which were not quite finished, and finished off the Sigmarillion, what I've forgotten the other names of different books. A lot of material, but not finally written by J.R.R. Tolkien, though it comes out under his name. So maybe we're dealing with a community here that loved the beloved disciple, whichever John he was. Let's assume John the Apostle, that's the tradition, and is now, but there's another John, maybe John the Presbyter, the elder, the one who says, introduced himself as the elder here, maybe he's the one who writes the letters. So the author of 2 John exercises the authority of an elder in the area and seems to be addressing a network of local house churches. It's quite possible that this was a covering letter accompanying the treatise which we know and have just studied, which is called 1 John. It accents the importance of not offering hospitality to the false teachers, thus allowing them to continue influencing those who are struggling to remain faithful to the traditional gospel and community. It's a brief letter fitting onto one papyrus sheet. Eusebius follows Origen in listing this letter as among the disputed writings. So in the very early 4th century, let's say 300 will do, or very shortly after, when Eusebius writes his history of the church, which he, by the way, re-edited after Constantine, but the bulk of it was written prior, during the period of persecution, Then when Constant took over, Eusebius got quite excited about all this and rewrote some of it and added to it and so on. So we're talking about the very early 4th century. He has a list, it's one of the earliest lists we've got, of the canonical writings, the ones that, in other words, everybody everywhere seems to read them and relish them and copy them and hand them around. But then he's got other works, including 2 Peter here, this letter, which he said, well, that's disputed, meaning some communities read it and cherish it and other communities are not so sure and all that kind of thing. But later on it will become part of the official canon. So that indicates that in the 4th century it still lacked solid recognition as an inspired work of the New Testament. Verses 1 to 9 are preserved, as may interest you, on a parchment sheet from about 300 AD. And that's the earliest bit we've got, earliest actual manuscript. But it's preserved in its entirety in the 4th century parchment codexes, that is, you know, written on the skin, Vaticanus and Cyrenaiticus, and in the 5th century parchment codex Alexandrinus. 2 John appears only once in the official church lectionary, when the first part of verse 1 and verses 3 to 9 are read on Friday of week 32 of ordinary time, year 2. So if you happen to miss 2 John when you go to church, well, you'd have to go on that year 2 on Friday of week 32 of ordinary time, and then you just hear 7 or 8 verses of it, and that's it. So don't be surprised. In other words, it's not a very central document of the New Testament.